Welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA Podcast Network. I am your host, Nick Agar-Johnson, and I'm here today for the first time in a while. It's been a minute, but I'm here today with Corey Tulliba to talk about his most recent article over on NoCeilingsNBA.com. Corey, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
Nick, I am excited to chop it up with you, man. It has been a minute. I'm trying to think. Was it the Chase Ross piece I'd done at the beginning of the cycle?
Yeah.
Well, as you know, as a member of NoCeilingsNBA.com, busy time of the year, the best time of the year, and I'm excited to have a conversation much more pertinent to this draft than the one that we ultimately had at the beginning of the cycle.
Yeah, we don't need to go back on that, but let's dive right into the article that you wrote most recently on Ron Holland and surf lessons from Kunu. So I want to start where you start with the piece, with a wonderful clip from Forgetting Sarah Marshall and sort of the emphasis on the idea of doing less. And that, I think, is a relevant conversation for pretty much all prospects, but certainly we'll get into sort of the specifics of the Ron Holland side of it. But I want to start out just sort of more generally. I'm curious, what sort of led you to use that as the lead-in to this Ron Holland piece that you wrote?
Well, I have been coaching high school basketball at the varsity level for 10 years. And so, you know, I have experience with the developmental process of seeing kids from, you know, when they're in middle school and, you know, by the time they reach, you know, the varsity level, seeing how that development goes and seeing how they develop at each level. Because when you start out at middle school and then you go to JV and then you go to varsity, or if you're skipping steps and maybe you're just going from middle school to varsity or whatever, every time you jump up a level, there's a lot of things that you're not expecting because of the speed of the game, or maybe it is the size and the physicality. And so a lot of young kids typically tend to get really sped up when they're pressured and in tight situations. And they think that the solution to their problems are to play faster and to do more instead of taking a step back, dialing down and slowing down so that they can just make a play that is maybe going to lead to another pass or a single instead of going for some kind of home run type situation. And so, you know, when I was watching Forgetting Sarah Marshall the other day, I think Netflix had put it back up fairly recently, you know, seeing that scene, I went, oh man, like that really actually resonates with me. And, you know, as somebody who has taken a surf lesson in Hawaii and then gone out on a board, you know, like having experienced that and understanding, like, if you're doing too much with your body trying to stand on a surfboard, you are not going to stand on that surfboard. And in that process, you are going to fail a lot before you succeed. But it really is true. Like, the more you simplify that process, the more likely you are to have success in your game. And so, you know, when I was thinking, you know, how can I turn this into a piece? I thought that, you know, it would be fun to, you know, kind of use this as a philosophical way to talk about Ron Holland, who is somebody that, you know, we've been tracking for a long time now. And, you know, is one of the most hotly debated prospects right now. Somebody who came in as potential number one pick. And now, you know, we see he's working out for teams as far back as the Lakers at 17, right? And, you know, watching Ron's process through the year, jumping up a level, right? Going from high school to the pros, not even, you know, kind of skipping that step. And especially not only doing that, but entering in from a role where he was known as this motor guy, hustle or whatever. And now he's going up a level and playing with the ball in his hands. The theme of doing less just kind of spoke to me, because I think a lot of times with young prospects, again, it could be whatever level they want to do more, but doing more doesn't always lead to success. And, you know, sometimes just simply playing a dialed back game actually is way more effective, but young prospects don't always understand that. Young players don't always understand that. Especially as they are trying to experiment, you know, you want to not be limited, right? So it's a very fine balancing act. But ultimately I think, you know, introing in the piece that way kind of allowed me to lay the groundwork that, like, I'm not saying that this prospect that I'm going to talk about is somebody who can't find success, but it might not be in the way necessarily that he's perceived.
It's interesting to me. I feel like this is a topic that I talk about all the time because it interests me, but also particularly was a focus in the episode that I did last week with Rowan talking about Auburn's Jalen Williams, where for the vast majority of NBA players, they were the best player on their high school team. Like basically pretty much, unless they played at IMG or Montverde, and even then they were probably the second best or the third best player. And then, you know, most of these players, they get to wherever the next level is, whether it be in the G League for the G League Ignite or, you know, on their college team or, you know, for certain international prospects, you know, going up from the B team or the U18 team to the main team, you know, there's a transition that happens almost every single one of those times where, you know, by the time you make it to the NBA level, I mean, this was also a conversation that I had with Rucker a couple weeks ago, right? Like even the all-time draft classes, like the 2003 draft class, 9 of the players selected ended up being all-stars, right? That's a pretty small percentage for the best of these classes. And so, you know, then it becomes a matter of, okay, are you someone who is willing and able to make that transition from, I have the ball in my hands all the time, I'm sort of the main guy, to can I fit into a context of an NBA team, whether it be, you know, hopefully you would be a starter, but even then, in the sense of can you, you know, scale down to be a 10-15 minute a game rotation player? And as you brought up in the piece with Ron Holland, it's fascinating because, you know, before he went to the G League Ignite, you know, at Duncanville, that was the sort of reputation of him as a high motor guy, you know, can fill a lot of gaps for you. And then he gets the ball in his hands all the time for the G League team. And, you know, it's a step up in level. Obviously, I think, as you mentioned, it's, you know, more of a skipping a step, right? Going from high school directly to a professional squad. And it changes the profile when, you know, you think of Ron Holland, guy who has the ball in his hands all the time, versus Ron Holland, energy guy.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing with the skipping the step, it's like you're skipping a step into a situation that is only sort of a mirage of what the ultimate context is that you want to be.
Sure.
There's so much up and down, free flowing. It's loose, you know, even for teams that are, you know, the affiliates of the NBA team, not, you know, the G League Ignite, who were their own thing. And there's an element of it all where there is a little bit more room for just playing sped up because it's just typically how the games are. So yeah, it's certainly, you know, an interesting context when you look at the entire situation. And like, you know, you mentioned Ron being the best or second best player, like, you know, he was playing off of a guy like Anthony Black, and then, you know, he evolved into this other thing. And, you know, it's just Ron's development in that way, it's like, you know, we've kind of seen him have success this one way, and now he's tried this other path. And it's like, if you really wanted to, you can argue that he did have success this year, right? Like he was productive. He did show a lot of positives. There were things that he got to show that you believe will translate to that next level. And then you'll do a deeper dive. And maybe if you're, you know, more pessimistic of that outcome, you can point to all of these other things that show that maybe it wasn't as successful as it seemed on the surface. But at the end of the day, it certainly, for the last time, given, you know, the G League Ignite program has folded, is, you know, we'll see what this program ultimately means for an NBA prospect's development.
So let's start off with some of the positives with Holland. And this is, I think, you know, it points to the conversation that we've already been having, but I think, you know, I certainly am happy that you sort of started with the positives in the piece to sort of drill down into the areas where he was successful. And the biggest one was, as you point out right at the top, in transition, and in particular, in transition when he attacked the basket. And this, I think, is, you know, one that will be indicative of wherever Ron Holland ends up, you know, however successful he ends up being, you know, whether he reaches the highest heights of his biggest benefactors or, you know, sort of falls to the level that his greatest detractors might think he might fall to. I think the one area that pretty much everybody agrees on that he's successful at is he's 6'8" and he's very athletic and he runs the floor very well in transition. And, you know, it's interesting because there's a little bit of a hint of some of the areas that might be a bit more questionable for him within that transition stuff. But when you're talking about him purely as someone who's attacking the basket in transition, as opposed to pulling up in transition, he was exceptionally successful as an 18-year-old in a professional league. You know, say what you will about the G League Ignite as a program, it was a professional league, right? It's a step up from, you know, being, say, a, you know, Division I school, not in a power conference, right? It's a pretty big leap forward in competition. And in that regard, he was very successful, even with the jump that he made to be on the G League Ignite.
Yeah. And look, you know, I don't necessarily know if Ron is this like elite athlete in the same vein as Cam Whitmore and, you know, a Thompson twin, somebody like that. But he is undeniably a very good athlete. And when he is in the open floor, he can succeed there in a bunch of different ways. So it isn't just as if he is somebody who has to just run the wing and fill the wing, and you know, you can throw the ball up in the air to him so he can finish there, or you can hit him, you know, on a 3-on-2 or something, and you know, he can finish off the wing. He can do that, right? Like that is something that he can do, which makes it valuable. But he can also crash the boards, get a rebound, grab and go, lead the break, go coast to coast. So, you know, there are multiple ways in which he can be successful in transition. And even when he isn't, you know, throwing it down or finishing a layup, you know, he can do some other things. He's really good at creating contact in general and getting to the free throw line. I think it's important when you're looking at somebody's NBA context to figure out like what are your day one ready skills that if you are hoping to have any level of success, like where are the areas that I know I can immediately contribute? And, you know, transition is something he's going to be able to rely on. You know, I used Cam Whitmore and Josh Green as guys who have and Bilal Coulibaly as guys who had played at a pace that allowed them to have a similar number of transition possessions. And so I think we can expect Ron to probably, you know, have a quarter of his possessions still at the next level be transition baskets. And if you're looking at a team that really wants to play with pace, and if you have a young team, typically, you know, what do you want to do with a young team? You want to get out and go, and you got to figure out ways to score when the defense isn't set, because young guys aren't necessarily the best at executing when they're all on the court together. Again, as we saw with this Ignite team. So the fact that he has that as a day one ready skill, I think is important. It's hard to rely on transition if that is the only thing that you can do, because you can't just be like, all right, we're going to go again. We're going to run and we're going to keep doing it, because eventually you can't do it every single possession. But the fact that he can, and he's successful at it, and there's no reason to believe that he won't be successful at that part of his game at the next level, I think, you know, is something he can hang his hat on.
And something else that he can hang his hat on, which I think is more relevant when you're talking about, you know, the vast majority of possessions that a team isn't running out in transition, is his cutting. And that's one, you know, cutting is a skill that I've focused on, you know, pretty heavily for the last few cycles. I think Metcalf and I talked the topic to death before, you know, deep dives became part of the No Ceilings feed, but, you know, sort of bring it back up again. And I think the idea there is, you know, okay, if you're in a half court set with Ron Holland on the wing, right, you know, what is he going to do that's going to be able to make him successful in that context, rather than purely just the context of, okay, you know, he can grab and go in transition, he can fill the wing, right? What is he going to be able to do at a high level when he doesn't have the ball in his hands in the half court? And, you know, it wasn't particularly a large part of his profile volume wise, but it was something that he was very successful at, and certainly something that whatever NBA team ends up drafting him will rely on him to do, you know, to sort of fill things out in a half court offense.
Yeah. You know, and look, whether it's like, you know, Chicago used to run, you know, a play to get Jimmy Butler coming off a back screen, and they would throw an alley-oop at the rim that he can go up and get, you know, so whether it's something like that, or, you know, he's cutting in from the corner, you're not going to be able to cut consistently similar to transition, where you're, you know, just getting these free buckets time after time, because people will eventually pay attention to you. But, you know, so like typically, like, you know, he had 3% of his possessions as cuts. That's kind of what it is with wings. You know, like, you're not going to have a 10% cut possession guy, really, because it's just hard to consistently backdoor cut somebody and get free buckets. But if you can do it once a game, because the thing is, if you don't have the threat of a shot, teams are going to sag off of you. They are going to ignore you. Like, we are seeing that with the Celtics and like a guy like Derrick Jones Jr. in the finals, and Derrick Jones Jr. is hitting his shots. You know, like, it doesn't matter if you hit five shots in a row. If you are ultimately a 25% three-point shooter, teams are going to be like, you need to hit the sixth one, you know? And so if you are being ignored and on, you know, the weak side of the floor, you need to at least, you know, once a game, make sure that that defender is still paying attention to you by, you know, sneaking in and getting an easy bucket, or, you know, running, you know, screening and rolling. And I think that being a guy who played power forward in high school, you know, maybe we'll see a little more screen and roll action for Ron. Because we know now that, like, teams are not constrained to this antiquated way of looking at basketball where the center has to be the screener. We see guard to big screens. We see, you know, wing to wing. So, you know, I think that could be an avenue in which maybe it's not exactly a cut, but it's kind of similar in, you know, whether you're going to slip it, you're going to ghost it, or you're just making contact and rolling. There's still the action of you using your momentum to receive a pass and finish towards the hoop, where, you know, I think one of the things I didn't really fully go into in the piece, I just added as a footnote, Ron wasn't awesome as a half court finisher. You know, a large percentage of, you know, a reason why he was a, you know, had an overall plus mark at the rim was because he was getting out in transition so often. But when it came to the half court, he was only 53%. So if he can get easier stuff at the rim instead of making it all self-created stuff, that'll boost that efficiency near the hoop too. Because if you're going to be an uber athletic wing, you also need to be able to finish efficiently in the half court. So I think that aspect of his game, while it isn't going to just strictly be off ball cuts, I do think he has opportunity there to utilize, you know, the theoretical approach to a cut in different ways to get himself opportunities near the rim.
Yeah. I mean, really, you know, a lot of this conversation is just sort of going back to, what does he do when he doesn't have the ball in his hands? Right. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, pick and roll stuff. He certainly handled the ball in the pick and roll more than he screened for the G League Ignite, which was a choice that their offense made. But, you know, those are actually some of his better plays. I mean, per synergy, he was, you know, pretty decent, 59th percentile as a pick and roll ball handler. So if he's someone who, you know, okay, if there's a screen set at the top of the key, if he's handling the ball, you know, maybe you're not as happy with it. But if it's the kind of thing where you can have him in those wing sort of actions, you know, where either he's setting the screen or he's running the pick and roll, then there's at least a little bit more variety that defenses have to pay attention to, rather than, okay, you know, he's stationed in the corner, so we can just play 5-on-4 because we know he's not going to be shooting.
Right. And that's the whole ball game. You don't want to put your team at a disadvantage offensively, because, you know, hey, look, we could talk about, and I'm sure we will, some like the shot making flashes. They were flashes and they were few and far between. So like, he has to find these opportunities in half court when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. Cause, you know, it's easy to be like, hey, I'm going to sign with the G League Ignite because I want the ball in my hands, cause I'm trying to develop that part of my game. And that's why I'm choosing this developmental context over going to Texas. It's harder when you get drafted to a team, like, whether it's him going 5 to Detroit and playing off of Cade Cunningham, or him slipping to 17 and playing off of LeBron James. Chances are you are not having that same usage. Unless there are a tremendous amount of injuries, you are going to not have the ball in your hands as much as you did with the G League Ignite. So how can you contribute when you don't?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be stunned if he had even 2/3 of the usage rate that he had at the G League Ignite when he makes it to his next NBA stop. But, you know, before we move into the defense, which I think is a very important part of the Ron Holland conversation, you know, I do just want to stick with that point that you were making for a moment, which is, Ron Holland, I think more than almost anyone else in this class, and if I'm forgetting someone, please, you know, call me out. But for him, I think it will matter where he goes more than almost anyone else in the class, because if he does end up going 17th to the Lakers, there's a whole lot less of a sort of expectation that, all right, you have to pick up the slack, you have to be a major cog in our offense right away. Whereas, you know, if one of the other outside the lottery teams that he reportedly worked out for was the Miami Heat. If he goes to the Miami Heat, then, you know, it seems almost like a given that his defense is going to be emphasized, that his play off ball offensively is going to be emphasized. And you might end up with a much better career for Ron Holland if he ends up in that spot, as opposed to, you know, he goes to Detroit at five, and you know, Detroit's a specific thing because, you know, Cade and Asar Thompson and Jaden Ivey will have the ball more than he will anyway. But you know, that sort of idea of if he goes top five, there's an expectation there that sort of forces him into more of an on-ball role. Whereas if he does end up falling, maybe that's actually best for his long-term career projection because he can bring along the other parts of his offensive game more slowly and key in on the off-ball stuff and key in on the defense instead.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think when you go to a place like a Miami, you know, not being relied upon to be that offensive guy, even from your fan base, right? And just it allows you to focus on what you're good at first and figure out how you can be a positive contributor, because these are teams that are going to try to win. And you're not going to play if you're going to play your way. You're going to play your way, you are going to be part of the G League affiliate or, you know, just riding the bench. So just focusing on the things that we had alluded to with the offense and then playing defense, you know, those are the things that you can kind of, because even if defense is your strength, as a rookie, you're still going to probably be bad at it. You might have flashes of, you know, positive moments where you're going to be like, oh, this guy's going to be a really good defender one day. But ultimately, it's so much more than just like guarding your man, right? Like there's so much going on in NBA offenses. You have to process all of these different things. And like Ron struggled with that a little bit this year. You know, he was either like attached to his man or he was ball watching. And processing multiple actions, I thought, was something that he kind of struggled with at times. Now, he has tools to where, like, his recovery ability would allow him to recover in ways that, like, it won't always at the next level. But he can get reps focusing on those things, which will eventually allow him to maybe expand his game into some of the things that he showed off. Because if you can't get developmental minutes, you're not going to develop those other parts of your game. So you kind of have to keep it simple, going back to the theme of the piece, and do less in order for you to even earn the trust that you can, you know, go out and do more. But like defensively, he has tools, right? He's got a 6'11 wingspan. He's 6'8. He's not like Cam Whitmore strong, but he's not, you know, weak by any means. When he, you know, he's always been known to be like a defensive motor guy. And I think that the fact that he did have a 30% usage, he had to learn how to balance using that energy all on offense and then going back and playing two ways. And sometimes that would wax and wane, but ultimately, you know, I think he'll focus more on the defensive aspect. He'll be, you know, at least have that effort and be locked in a little bit more easily, given he won't have to expend as much energy offensively. And I think he'll show some really positive flashes, you know, once he steps onto the floor, just whether it is running down a block shot or, you know, making a hustle play, diving on the floor, you know, playing one-on-one, shooting the gap. Like there are a lot of things that, you know, intrigue you about Ron as a defender. He said on the pod with KOC, he, you know, one of his goals was to maybe win a defensive player of the year, you know? So like if he's really focused on that goal and, you know, locking in on that side of the floor, he certainly has a lot of tools that make him a really interesting prospect.
Yeah. And, you know, even just sort of beyond the tools, you know, you mentioned the very high usage rate, which is certainly one thing on the offensive end. But even with that, you know, he had steal and block rates that were better than everybody in the class, except for Reed Shepard. His defensive rebounding rate, as you note in the piece, was higher than any of his, you know, college peers age wise. Right. And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, I bring it up to the point where I'm almost sick of bringing it up. I'm sure people listening are definitely sick of me bringing it up, but steals translate at a higher rate from non-NBA level to the NBA level than any other statistic. And it's the kind of thing where you have to be careful, because if you just look at a high steal rate, it could be, you know, a Kawhi Leonard who excels at stripping the ball, who excels at, you know, jumping passing lanes, or it could be a Russell Westbrook who, you know, 10 possessions, he'll gamble wildly on all 10 and two of them will be steals and the other eight will be easy layups because, you know, he jumped the passing lane that, you know, their ball wasn't actually going through that passing lane, right? But with Holland, you know, I think a lot of it is that, you know, yeah, there's a bit of the ball watching, certainly, but, you know, ultimately the steal rate that he has is pretty translatable and certainly the kind of thing where, you know, he can figure out how to be smarter with gambles, right? I mean, I bring up Westbrook as the negative example, but, you know, even still, there's a lot to be said for the fact that he does have those on-ball strips, as you mentioned in the piece. It's not just purely gambling on every possession that allows him to get to those thresholds. And so, yeah, you know, it's not just what you can see with the physical traits. It's not just what you can see on the film, but it's also pretty clear in the numbers that he does have a toolkit of translatable defensive skills.
Yeah. And I think, you know, similar to, you know, like steal rate, I think, you know, the defensive rebounding is something along those lines as well that is pretty translatable. So, you know, again, like there are a lot of indicators that make you say, I get why somebody would buy into Ron Holland, the prospect, especially when you were looking at him from the lens of these things, which are more like, you know, like the role player hustle stat things. It's not to say that stars are not also defending and rebounding, but as the baseline skills of what he can do, you know, he has positive indicators for sure.
And so that leads into a question that I think, you know, in addition to what you brought up at the beginning, I think is also really the heart of the piece. So I'm just going to quote you directly here because you said it better than I could. The question I've often asked myself in regards to Holland's evaluation is he willing to be a great role player? And this, I think, feeds into everything we've been talking about, right? Where it's like, there are all these positive signs that he has, all these positive role player traits that if he's willing to fit into that kind of context, that, you know, there is a lot of reason to believe that he'll succeed. But the question, as it becomes with pretty much all of these players who are used to having the ball in their hands a lot, are used to being the focus of the offense, it's, can you effectively, you know, transition away from being the lead guy while still providing that same kind of hustle, that same kind of value in the sort of role player skills? And, you know, it's funny because with Holland, there's evidence, you know, that points in favor. There's positive evidence that, yes, he can do that. And there's also, you know, this last season with the G League Ignite where he was not quite as willing to give up the ball in context where maybe he should have, you know, taken a little bit of the gas off the pedal, right? In terms of, you know, how much he was being the lead guy for the offense.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a really hard thing. Basketball is about sacrifice at every level, right? Like you have to just be willing to concede things that you kind of wish that you wouldn't, right? Like that's what separates the great teams from the good teams, from the good teams to the bad teams, and like from organized basketball, from like playing pickup, you know, like being able to sacrifice for the person that is next to you, for the person that is behind you or in front of you. These are the things that you need to do and you need to be willing to do. And when you're 18, because we're talking about one of the youngest prospects in the draft, who just had a season where he had a 30% usage and clearly chose the kind of developmental context where he was like, I am going to cook over, like, I am going to be held accountable and, you know, have to sacrifice a little bit. Like the Ignite situation is the situation you go to when you don't want to sacrifice.
Sure.
You know, now part of that is like, I just want to be a professional. I don't want to go to college, right? Like I just want, but at the end of the day, like we've seen, you know, it's less about that now than it used to be a few years ago before NIL came into the picture, right?
Yes, like, absolutely.
So you have to ask that question. If you're going to invest a super high pick into somebody, it's like, are they going to be willing to sacrifice? And the only person that knows that is Ron Holland, you know, like, and look, we can listen and prospects can say all of the right things, but at the end of the day, it's like actions speak louder than words. So are your actions going to back up the words? And I think that's a legitimate question that I struggle with because I just think it's hard. You know, when you're 18 and you got people, oh, you're going to be a lottery pick, you know, like you're a five-star, you know, you're an All-American, you just went to the pros, you're ready to, like, you didn't go to college, like you were a pro, man, like you're going to step in. These are what, like, there are handlers around you and people around you that are saying things. This is just a real thing, right? Like you can go and watch, you know, any movie that mirrors that kind of situation, you know, like go watch He Got Game. Like people are asking things of you. They're putting things in your ear and it's hard to block out that noise sometimes. And we see people who are able to do it. We see people who are unable to do it. But the fact of the matter is it's happening. And so coming from that context, yo, you averaged 20 points in the G League. Like, what do you mean? Like, you gotta go and be a scorer. Like, that's what you are. Not every prospect is willing to take that step back, look at what they can really do and adapt to that. And, you know, once you get there, if you're unwilling to adapt and you start struggling, maybe you lose confidence, right? Like, and maybe you kind of lose who you are and where you fit in. And now all of a sudden, you know, it can spiral because you are a teenager.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that basketball is about sacrifice. And I think that's a very key point to bring up. And it's funny because we're seeing an example of it right now in the NBA finals with Jason Tatum, who, you know, literally all NBA guy, right? It's not just coming into the league at 18 and you're not sure what you are yet, but you know, if he shot as much and as willingly as he has during his better games in the regular season, maybe the Celtics aren't up 2-0. But instead, you know, he accepted, okay, I'm getting double and triple teamed, so the right play is for me to pass out on pretty much every possession. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he puts up double digit assists in the last game because, yeah, you know, he will shoot occasionally, right? But it's like, if the defense is double and triple teaming me, the right choice is to make that sacrifice. But the flip side of that is how much of basketball is also about confidence, right? You know, we talk about it all the time with, you know, and I think it's particularly indicative for someone like Ron Holland, where, you know, he's not the guy who's asked like, okay, you're going to sit on the bench for 21 minutes. And then with 3 minutes left in the second quarter, we're expecting you to check in and hit 2 threes, you know, just off the wing, right? Like, he's not going to be brought in off the bench to be a shooter. So there's that element, which is, you know, maybe a little bit different, but, you know, there's also the element of, if you're expecting him to be an energy guy and you're expecting him to attack constantly, if he loses his confidence, is that going to be something that he's willing to do? And it's difficult to evaluate for guys who've been in the NBA for a long period of time. It's nearly impossible to evaluate for, again, an 18-year-old who just put up 20 points a game in a professional league.
Yeah, and that's what makes a draft a crapshoot and a gamble. It's just like there are unanswerable questions. And when you're looking at a prospect who has such a high variance and volatility, it's these are the things you have to consider and make bets on. And you know that this is where a lot of the behind the scenes stuff comes in, but at the end of the day, even with a lot of that stuff, you still have to make that gamble and try to, because it, a lot of the time it could be even beyond that, right? Like, you can be drafted into a situation and then guess what, your head of basketball operations is no longer there, the coach is gone, and now all of a sudden there's a new regime who maybe didn't like you as much. So, you know, like I'm interested to see what happens in Detroit with all the prospects that they have now that Troy Weaver's out, and like, who do they look at as a long-term piece? Right. Like, probably just Cade.
Yeah.
If that would be to my guess,
it'd be just Cade.
You know, like, I'm sure they're willing to see what they have in some of these other guys, but like, it's probably just Cade is the only guy who is definitively a part of their future. So there's just so many variables in the NBA and then in team building in general. And with the amount of turnover, you know, in coaching staffs, you know, players who really need development, like, there's a big difference if you get drafted by Oklahoma City with a bunch of people that have, you know, stability versus a place like Detroit where it's like, all right, we just gave Monty Williams all of the money in the world. But like, yeah, we might be also willing to buy him out and eat that. So it's like, you know, you need stability to also develop, so you're not constantly learning different things from different people and you have one person saying this and one person saying that. So not only do you have the background noise, but now you have all the noise of dealing with just the realities of the NBA. And it's a lot for any prospect to take on. And it's certainly a lot with one that has so many areas of their game that they really need to focus in on and hone and kind of become adequate at to kind of reach the caliber of prospect that they might believe themselves to be.
So speaking of development areas, let's dive into some of those, you know, we'll be generous and call them developmental areas for,
yeah, I think I called them refinement areas.
Yes, there we go. Refinement areas. And so I'm just going to quote from the piece because this made me laugh when I was editing it. When Siegel is first introduced to Rudd's character in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Rudd introduces himself as Kunu. When asked by Peter what Kunu means, he replies, it means Chuck. Chuck is unfortunately what Ron Holland did a lot during his time with the G League night. So that made me laugh. So I, you know, repeating it on the podcast so I can laugh again. But yeah, I mean, that's really the issue, right? Is, you know, something we've been drilling in on this entire episode of, man, you look at Ron Holland, the role player, and there's a lot to like. You look at Ron Holland, the primary offensive option, and there are some refinement areas.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and that's the toughest part, you know, like, because there, you want to buy into this other stuff, but when I see a guy who is clearly a poor shooter who is pulling up with 21 seconds in the shot clock, you know, for an above the break three, when there are other options to get easier stuff, it's just like, man, I don't like seeing that. And then you start looking at some of the other stuff, right? Like, just kickouts to him where he's hesitating to shoot. And because he missed his window to step into a catch and shoot three, even if it is contested, well, now he's actually just going to jab step and shoot the ball anyway. right? And or he's going to shoot a shot that is just like his feet aren't set. He's not balanced. He's barely looking at the rim. Somebody's draped all over him. And now he's shooting a 17-foot fall away from the baseline. And you're just like, there is a level of feel in how to operate with the ball in their hand, you know, in his hands, that is just messy. And it ultimately, the way I view it, especially, you know, from the mindset of somebody who's been coaching young guys, is it's like, if I am a coach and an NBA level coach, one that is probably hoping that I'm winning the game that I'm coaching, am I going to put somebody on the floor that is consistently taking something off of the table for me? You know, it's one thing to kind of like be kind of risk averse and, you know, kind of be like, hey, is this guy on the floor? Like Patrick Williams, you know, like he doesn't necessarily always stand out the way you want him to given his physical gifts, but he very rarely is taking anything off of, you know, the table when he's out on the floor. Ron takes stuff off the table. And when you're making those mistakes and you're breaking out of a system, not to say that the G League Ignite particularly might have had a system to break out of, right? Like that's part of the freedom of that experience. But if you're breaking out of that, because that's how you played last year when you first got this opportunity to play that way, and now you're doing it on an NBA floor, an NBA coach is going to be a lot less enthused about some of those choices than maybe, you know, the G League Ignite program was. You are going to be on the bench because you have to be held accountable. Because if you are not held accountable in that circumstance, you are going to think that it's okay that you did that. So you are either going to have a coach who it's like, and a system and a team who is like, well, we're just trying to lose so we can get a high pick. And you're going to build up those bad habits. And maybe it's too late before you figure it out. Or you're going to have a coach who holds you accountable and you're not going to get a lot of playing time until you fix it. So another variable that we don't know about right now, but it's like a very serious thing that I think you have to consider with him. Because yeah, like you look at that Perth game, that kind of step back three from the right wing that he knocks down, like you're like, wow, like that's a legit like shot maker shot. But if you go and look at the larger context of Ron as a shooter and as a shot maker, it's like, how much can you buy into flashes when all of the percentages are like, you know, in the toilet? So it's a lot. It was a lot of chucking. And again, to me, if I'm going to draft Ron with a high lottery pick, like this is the question that I have to ask myself, like, is he willing to dial that stuff back and keep the game simple and do less?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, really the concept, and you know, this is something where I feel like it's important to be willing to be wrong in the draft space. If you're, you know, willing to hold yourself accountable for your mistakes. And I was too low on Cam Thomas. And the reason I was too low on Cam Thomas was, you know, firstly, is he going to have the ball in his hands as much as he did at LSU at Oak Hill, right? And the second part being, he takes stuff off the table. He's, you know, unlike with Ron Holland, you can't rely on Cam Thomas to do anything defensively. And so then the question becomes, okay, you know, with Cam, I was wrong because turns out he was spectacular enough as a scorer to be able to make up for the things that he takes off the table. But, you know, with Holland, you're relying on, you know, if you're relying on that to be the driver of, yeah, he's a high lottery pick because, you know, he scored 20 points a game, is like, but, you know, he scored 20 points a game in a context where, you know, again, as you mentioned, he wasn't getting pulled for taking bad shots, right? That's something that no matter where he goes, you know, there's going to be a higher standard, even for, you know, a team that is considering itself as tanking, you know, certainly early on, right? October, November, you know, pretty much no team is deciding, yeah, the season's already done, right? And right. So at that point, you know, you do get held accountable for those kinds of things in a way that, you know, for as much positive as he put on tape for the G League Ignite, you know, he was not being held accountable for taking those, you know, as you mentioned, that pull up three with 21 seconds left on the shot clock.
And here's the other thing, like you might not just be held accountable in the way that you are going to be benched. You might be held accountable in the fact that you are no longer on the main roster. We're sending you down to our G League affiliate.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's also another worry, because I think Ron is like clearly somebody who needs like more reps in situations. But like if he goes down to the G League, what is going to stop him and prevent him from continuing to play the way that he played last year in the G League, which is like not going to, in my opinion, evaluation going to be the things that he needs to improve on to get onto the floor in real games, right? Like it might just continue to teach him bad habits. Like it could show that, like, all right, well, Ron Holland is better than a G leaguer, which is like, okay, I think we all agree on this, right? Like, then your average G-leaguer, Ron Holland, is a better talent than that. That's why he was able to score 20 points per game in the G League as an 18-year-old. But like, if you're just using it as a bar of, is this guy more talented than NBA player, than G League players? And it's like, okay, I guess we can figure that out, right? Because we saw with Cam Whitmore, like he went down there and he was like dominant, but ultimately he wasn't learning the skills and the deficiencies that he had that are going to endear you to more to the coaching staff. It's like, okay, we know you can score. We know you can shoot it a little bit. We know you're athletic. I would really like to see you score less in the G League. Like, what if you, instead of we're going for 30 every game, like what if you went for 22, but you also had 7 assists? And that's not necessarily the way that, you know, the G League plays. And so, and a young player's first instinct is, I want to score. You know, like not everybody has the mindset of sacrificing things. So, you know, that's kind of the other conundrum where it's like, if Ron is probably somebody who needs more G League reps, but I don't know if him getting more G League reps is even going to help him become who I think, you know, he needs to become to be most successful in the league.
So let's wrap up by, you know, sort of speculating about some of the potential outcomes here. And I'm just going to quote directly from the piece again. If the shot never comes around, what is the path? It's a heavy question for a team investing a high lottery pick. And that's, you know, I think ultimately touches on basically everything we've been talking about here. And you bring up a couple of options for Holland that I do want to get into in just a moment here. But, you know, that's really, I think, the idea here where, look, if, you know, he doesn't, if he gets to the point where his shot comes around, then all of this is moot, right? Like, okay, if his shot comes around, he's going to be fine, right? But right. Then the question is like, okay, great. You know, if Donovan Clingan becomes a 40% 3-point shooter and never gets injured again, then he's going to be fine too, right? Like that's, you know, if you look at the 99th percentile outcome, pretty much everybody who's even in consideration for going in the first round is going to look pretty good. But the question becomes, all right, you know, not even just a bad outcome, right? Not even a 25th percentile outcome. What is the 50th percentile outcome? What is the average version of Ron Holland that we see at the NBA level? And history tells us that, you know, the average outcome for a prospect is not they go from being a poor shooter to being an excellent shooter. And, you know, there's, it's not all bad when you look at the shot profile for Holland. You know, as you point out, you know, he hit 74% of his free throws, which is a nice touch indicator. You know, he was pretty good on shorter jumpers, short to 17-foot, you know, range. He hit 48%, which is, you know, not fantastic, but certainly not shot is broken kind of level. But ultimately, you know, with Holland, the question is, as you said, right, what happens if the shot stays where it is or, you know, only develops a little bit as opposed to, you know, again, the sort of pie in the sky 95th, 99th percentile outcome of he figures out the shot and he's an all-star, which, yeah, that's, you know, when you have everything else that Ron Holland has, if you figure out the shot to that degree, he's going to be just fine.
Yeah. And look, like I'm lower on his shot than I think some people, you know, I think 74% is a fine number, but it's not anything that indicates like positive touch. I think, you know, the short to 17 is like, you know, I wanted to include that because I didn't want it to be devoid of context from every area. Like there are shots in there that are around free throw line area, but a lot of them are also like baby hooks on the block, right? Which is not something that's necessarily going to translate, you know, to your shooting. But when we look at Ron, what makes it so difficult to like, all right, well, let's say he reaches his 50% outcome. We can sit and say like, all right, well, his shot just didn't come around, but he's going to fall back on these other things. It could be like, well, his shot didn't come around and he's still taking things off the table because he's still shooting these shots. And that could be what the 50th percentile outcome looks like, where he's doing other good things, but he's also taking stuff off the table. And it's like, that's when you get to the point. It's like, remember when Russell Westbrook was an MVP and he was doing all of this stuff and his athleticism was so great and his just sheer force was so impactful that it didn't matter what he took off the table because all of the things he did well, he put way more things on the table. But as soon as everything started to tail off a little bit and he could no longer be the focal point of what he was doing, the things that he took off of the table overwhelmed the things that he put back onto it. And it took, I think, a lot of, you know, maturity on his part to eventually get to a point where he can be like, okay, maybe I am not the MVP anymore. And I have to maybe come off the bench or be this change of pace energy guy. but it took him a while to get there. And, you know, not everybody does. And like, while you're, you know, breaking down shooting percentages, like, I think you also have to then sit and break down, like, why are the shooting percentages bad? You know, which I did a little bit, like some of the long twos he's taking, or he's being invited to take these shots. And like, there are good mid-range shots. There are bad mid-range shots. Yeah. Good mid-range shots are shots that you're dictating because you're getting to certain spots on the floor. And, you know, I use the example of Chris Paul, who's obviously an all-time great and, you know, is an outlier example, but like, he is getting to the elbow, whether he's just coming off the screen, you know, and getting there basic, or he's snaking it and getting to a spot because he's shifting the defense, because he can hit that shot. Now the big has to step up more in the drop. The defender on the weak side has to rotate down. And now he's opening different avenues where his playmaking ability comes in. Or you're Kawhi and you're able to, you know, be maybe Jordan and use your strength and your footwork, and you're able to do that. But in both circumstances, you're also able to make plays out of that spot. And I think Ron's basic lack of feel as a passer as well kind of leads me into believing that, like, you know, teams are inviting him into these bad mid-range shots. And a lot of them are taking place in between the foul line and the three-point line instead of, you know, around that elbow area. So, you know, again, like, are you going to continue to shoot those? Because teams are going to invite you to take those. And are you going to oblige? Because if you oblige, all of these percentile outcomes start getting a little iffy, because again, like, you know, it's going to hurt your efficiency. It's going to hurt what the offense is trying to do. It's going to cramp the floor. And ultimately, you know, it's going to make you hard to be an effective player. And unless you're just focusing strictly on all of that other stuff. And if you are maximizing the role player stuff, what percentile outcome is that? You know, is that 70? Is it 80? You know, like, are you going to be Andre Iguodala? Are you going to be, or older Andre Iguodala, right? Like, you know, are you going to be somebody like that? Ultimately, it's tough to say, you know? So that's why Ron is such kind of a tricky evaluation for me personally, because there just are so many things that are up in the air that make him enticing, but a lot of it might also just come back to mindset and who he wants to ultimately be.
So before we wrap up, let's just touch on the three team fits that you brought up at the end of the piece for Holland. And I think, you know, first of all, they're all instructive because they're all within the top 10, right? So, you know, looking at sort of, you know, higher outcomes in terms of where he gets drafted. But, you know, one of the options that you mentioned is Charlotte, where I think makes a lot of sense along the lines of sort of what we've been talking, in the sense of, you know, LaMelo's pretty entrenched there. You know, hopefully he stays healthy going forward. That's really the biggest thing for him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Brandon Miller had a spectacular rookie season. And so if he's going there, then the idea is, you know, almost before he even steps in the locker room, it's pretty clear that he's the third option at best. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then, as you mentioned, you know, he can buy into filling that sort of agent of chaos role. I mean, that Charlotte defense was atrocious, and he would certainly, you know, even a lower level defensive outcome for him, he would be at least a positive contributor sooner rather than later. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, which is absolutely correct, pretty much all rookies are terrible on defense, but, you know, it's the kind of thing where if by February or March, you know, you're seeing good signs of him fitting into a switching scheme, you know, reading passing lanes correctly, then you might have a lot of hope for him going forward. And, you know, similarly, another team that you mentioned is Utah, where, you know, again, same situation, right? Lauri Markkanen's going to be the lead guy, you know, Keontae George is going to take up a lot of the sort of offensive oxygen in a way that I think is positive for Ron Holland's development, in the sense of, look, you're going to have to focus on what you can do and, you know, do what you do best. And that's really what's going to get you playing time. That's what's going to make you a cog in the machine. And, you know, the other fit that you mentioned is one that we've already talked about with Detroit, where there isn't as much room to operate, where there aren't, you know, other spacing options who can give him the room to, you know, make those backdoor cuts, to, you know, get out and push the ball in transition. It's the kind of thing where, you know, we say for basically every prospect, right, they're, you know, maybe Tristan Da Silva, of like, it doesn't matter as much where you end up. Pretty much everywhere else, it's like, you have to be in the right team, in the right context for you to be able to maximize your skills. But, you know, I think the way that you end the piece is very indicative of what we're looking at with Ron Holland, of, you know, not every, I'm going to quote you again, not every wing prospect has to turn out to be Jaylen Brown or Paul George to have a successful NBA career. Sometimes it's just as cool to scale back your game and still be as impactful as Aaron Gordon has been in Denver. And, you know, if Ron Holland ends up being Aaron Gordon, then, you know, even if he ends up going sixth, that's pretty good value for the sixth pick. You know, most of the time, you know, again, even the best classes have nine all-stars, but, you know, most classes you're talking about, you know, three, four, five all-stars. If you're the sixth pick and you're as valuable for a team as Aaron Gordon has been, especially for Denver, then that's a pretty good outcome. And so if he goes to Charlotte and becomes Charlotte Aaron Gordon, that's a win for Charlotte. You know, if he goes to Detroit and becomes, trying to think of a good example here, but, you know, I don't know, like Jared Culver, that's not as good.
Josh Jackson.
Josh Jackson's a much better example.
Yeah. And that's kind of the whole thing with the draft. You know, we can sit and say like, oh, you just have to take best player available. But it's like, you also have to consider the aspects of team building that go beyond best player available, because if he is going to Detroit, and I understand it, you know, I apologize to Pistons fans for, you know, just beating you down here, but I'm sure you're already as far down as you can possibly get. So there's no lower level
anyway.
Like if I was Cade Cunningham and his agent and they drafted Ron Holland and I had to share the floor with Asar Thompson, who I really like as a player, and Ron Holland at the same time, and Jalen Duren, I'd be like, you guys got to get me out of here.
Yeah.
Like, I need to leave. Like, I'm sorry. Like, you just keep doing the same thing over and over, because the talent has to be overwhelming enough that it makes the fit questions irrelevant when you were making that choice. You know, it can't just be like, well, I think this guy has a little bit better potential in a vacuum, right? Like, it still has to make sense on the basketball court, because you're still playing basketball. And like, we know what is valuable in this league, and it is spacing, right? Like, the shooting three, like, you cannot win if you don't hit shots from outside. So if Holland is going to a team where he is going to hurt the spacing, he is playing alongside other guys who are also hurting the spacing, neither one of them are opening things up, it really does make things tricky. Because again, he could be a 35% shooter, you know, next year. Teams still aren't guarding Isaac Okoro, right? They're going to sacrifice one thing and make Isaac Okoro beat them, because Isaac Okoro beating them consistently from three, if you're in a playoff series, he's not doing that enough times that it's going to make you really pay. But if you were to leave Donovan Mitchell or Darius Garland open consistently, they're going to make you pay. So you're picking and choosing what you're, you know, allowing to kill you. And teams are going to allow Ron Holland to hurt them. They're going to be like, that step back shot that you hit, you know, a couple of times in the G League, please do it again. You know, like go for it, like shoot until your heart's content. So again, like, that's why I think the fit for Ron is so important. You know, like, OKC maybe is a better fit just because he'll help with rebounding. He has other guys who can space the floor. He's not taking the ball out of Shea's hand. He's not going to take the ball out of Jalen's hand. Chet can space the floor as a big for him, right? Like, they have Isaiah Joe. They have these options available where maybe he can just be like maybe what you wanted Terrence Ferguson to be, right? Like, ultimately. On the other hand, he could just be Terrence Ferguson. You know, like, there are multiple outcomes that, you know, you could potentially be. But like, you know, it's trickier for Ron than it is for other prospects. Like, you know, if he went to Chicago, a team that's, sure, Coby White is really good spacing the floor, and, you know, Adesumu has been a good shooter, but it goes back to the same thing. Io is not going to garner the respect of the defense in that similar way. And, you know, who knows what happens with Zach LaVine, but like, if DeMar DeRozan, if they re-sign him, and Vucevic, who is a theoretical shooter more than like a real threat there, and all of a sudden you're just looking at a clunky offense again, it's like, all right, Ron was really talented, but how does this help? You know, like, so I just really think that fit for Ron, and not only fit, but culture and environment, and, you know, how they can nurture the positive aspects of his game, I think are really going to determine ultimately, like, whether Ron is somebody who hits on his first team, or he's somebody that you're hoping to take a chance on with his second or third team and betting on, you know, his blue chip talent that he had as a high school prospect.
All right. Anything else you want to cover here before we wrap this one up?
No, I think, you know, I think that was it. I think everybody should go back and watch Forgetting Sarah Marshall, because it's a very funny film, which was, you know, that one particular scene in Kunu, and that character, Chuck, played by Paul Rudd, was, you know, the inspiration for it. And, you know, I think Ron is one of the more intriguing prospects. He's a guy that, you know, as going to the Hoop Summit last year, we saw him, and You know, I had my reservations there. And, you know, ultimately, I think I'm kind of in the same place with him that I started in that, like, I see the talent. It's abundantly clear that he's talented, but I have questions. But the fun part about this draft is every prospect has questions. There's not a single prospect that doesn't have a question mark. So some question marks are worth betting on more than others. And that's just going to come down to the personal preference of the person that is making the decision while they're on the clock. So it's going to be really interesting to see on, you know, June 26th, what that means for a guy like Ron Holland.
All right. Well, he is Corey Telleba. You can find him on Twitter at Corey Telleba, and you can find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com, including this Ron Holland piece from earlier this week. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.